Mental Health Monday on Radio City Talk. Tackling the stigma.
Yeah, welcome back to Mental Health Monday. My name's Mick Coyle. We're back for 2018. We're just going to carry on doing the show as we did throughout 2017. But also, we got something pretty big coming up next week. So as of next week, that's the 15th of January, we're going to be in the middle of the Mental Health Monday Marathon. Now, this is going to be something of a UK radio first, probably a world first, because we can't find anyone else who's actually done this. We're going to do a 24 hours worth of broadcasting talking about mental health. Now, it's not just going to be me sitting here talking about mental health. What we've done is we've scheduled an entire day of radio programming around this. So there's going to be a late night phone-in. There's going to be a sports show. There's going to be an opportunity to meet local organisations. There's going to be people who've been working in the field of mental health, people who've been affected by negative mental health throughout their lives as well, a whole host of different things. Over the course of today's show, we'll give you some of the details about some of the subjects we're going to be touching on and how we're going to be doing it, and also the fact that I can't do it by myself, so we've got some people to help out as well, because me talking for 24 hours isn't necessarily going to be happening, although I am going to be here in the studio for the entire 24 hours. In the meantime, of course, Mental Health Monday continues, because that's what we're about, talking about mental health every Monday here on Radio City Talk. And we're joined on the programme today by our first guest of 2018. I'm very pleased to say she's with us on the programme, Sarah Wolfe. Sarah, thank you for your time.
No problem, my pleasure.
Now, you are a clinical psychologist. First of all, just tell me a little bit about yourself and your own expertise.
Yeah, so I actually qualified as a clinical psychologist just last September, but I've worked in health and social care probably since about 2008, doing a range of things, but one of the things closest to my heart is working with looked after children and their parents and carers. So that's what I've chosen to specialise in. And I currently work up in Lancashire, but I live in Liverpool. I trained in Liverpool, and my heart is in Liverpool. So I'm happy to hear speaking with you today about looked after children and kind of things that might hopefully be relevant for people living in the Liverpool area.
No, absolutely. And actually some really interesting breakdown about sort of the outcomes in life and the issues in life that so-called looked after children face. Just give us the phrase looked after children. Can you explain what that means?
Yeah, absolutely. So people might traditionally think of children who live in residential care, i.e. in children's homes. There are also many, many children in foster care. And also nowadays, many people might not know that there are children who actually live at home with their own parents or people who have responsibility for them in a parental role, but they do actually live in the home with the family, but they are looked after by the local authority. So the local authority are there to kind of make sure those children are safe and appropriately looked after at home.
Is it fair to say that these children are vulnerable and varying degrees of vulnerability?
Absolutely, very much so. And when you think about some of the myths or some of the stories that people might not even realise that they actually tell. But if anybody listening can remember a time when their mum has kind of, you know, threatened to take them down to the local children's home if they don't behave themselves, there's a suggestion there that children associated with these places are naughty or bad in some way. But actually we are talking about young people who have sin, kind of the darkest side of humanity, and whose rights have been violated at the most basic and fundamental level in most cases. So absolutely, they develop a lot of vulnerabilities later on, and they're kind of hidden, really, in society a lot of the time.
Yeah, and I was going to say, because it's worth sort of, without being too sort of gruesome about the details, setting that out, because actually I think there'd be a lot of people listening to this who are thinking, yeah, but kids are kids, and they're resilient, and they'll bounce back. But actually, in your experience, the sort of things that you're trained in, these are kids who have witnessed just the worst possible things that can happen to anyone, not just young people.
Yeah, absolutely. So in Liverpool alone, just over 60% of the children that were in care last March were there as a result of abuse and neglect. I spend a bit of time on social media kind of connecting with people who are care experienced, and one young lad called AC, who's known as At The Care Kid, recently published his own blog about his experiences, and he talks about how him and his sister, their clothes were ripped and filthy, they were caked in dirt, soiled mattress, no bedding. They were running around the local area till all hours, weren't being fed enough. The bedrooms didn't have wallpaper or curtains. He was suffering non-accidental injuries, things like that, for which there's no explanation. So they're not always things that are that's obvious, but the sum total can kind of suggest that, you know, there are children that are really kind of going without.
Yeah, and I was going to say, from a mental health point of view, of course, you can have those injuries, physical injuries that appear on a child as well, but also there's the ramifications of that life that has been placed upon them, the sort of experiences that they have, and what happens over a period of, you know, 2 months, 3 months, 6 months, 3 years, and the damaging impact on that child long term.
Yeah, so not everybody kind of is kind of as much aware as we'd like about kind of the issues around development. So if you think about a baby who's just in utero, still growing, up to the first kind of 2 years of life, that period is considered a really critical window. So if I was to take something like domestic violence as an example, there's a recent article in The Echo back in September about rates of domestic violence in Liverpool being particularly high. If a lady is carrying a baby, or if the children at home, even if they're in a different room or they're upstairs, still just hearing these kind of experiences, hearing violence, you know, hearing threats, being around that kind of tense atmosphere that it creates, or being a baby that's developing in utero and being exposed to a mother's stress, you know, these things have a big impact on, you know, your sense of who you are, you know, where and what your body is about, what your feelings are, what you even call the feelings that you experience, and what to expect from other people. So ideally, you'd have a caregiver who could be available, would be very consistent, would give warmth, as well as things like food and shelter. And in absence of that, you know, the world suddenly is a very frightening place, and it's difficult to make sense of who you are as a person, what your life is about.
Now, this is what fascinates me, Sarah, actually, in terms of how you talk about that. So if a child grows up in that environment and has a sense that for them is the norm, that is a normality for them, that they are growing up in an abusive relationship where physical injuries against them are the norm, where do the mental health problems kick in then? Is that the moment where they realise that that's actually not the norm, or that that is a damaging environment, or is that just environment something which naturally leads itself to somebody more likely to be prone to mental health problems?
I think there is something about the idea about resilience, which is a word we've heard bandied about a little bit, and that kind of suggests that some children naturally can cope with adversity or difficulty better than others. But I would say what I see in terms of the impact on mental health is that a lot of children start to develop behavioural difficulties, and that's what people tend to focus on in terms of whether it's relatives around the person, perhaps carers or support workers, teachers. A lot of the focus is on the behaviour, but usually with the idea that this is undesirable behaviour that we might want to get rid of. But actually what you're kind of seeing is a child who doesn't have the ability to understand their own feelings and know how to manage them, know how to soothe themselves or calm themselves down, because of course they won't have necessarily had the opportunity to get that from a caregiver. If you've never had the experience, it's difficult to know kind of how to cope in these situations. And that's why we see, I believe, quite a high proportion of children perhaps being mislabeled, you know, with certain disorders, when actually what they might have experienced is what I'd call some form of complex trauma. That actually better explains the difficulties that they present with.
Yeah, I mean, I've got a figure here. Proportion of looked after children who've been in care for more than 12 months with special educational needs, we're talking 52.8%. Mm-hmm. So that is the majority of children there would be set aside as requiring extra help as well. Yeah. And just under 10% of those who have been looked after have had at least one fixed period of exclusion, who've been excluded from school.
Yes. Absolutely, and that is a concern. Another kind of gentleman that I've been having some contact with over social media, Ian Dixon, he's a care experienced gentleman, actually a former social worker and Ofsted inspector himself, and he talked about how education was absolutely crucial for him growing up in terms of giving him kind of a way out of kind of the care system, and a way of helping his story and his life to move away from those kind of early experiences and to give him a bit of hope and a bit of control over his own life. And absolutely, you know, care experienced people and looked after children have massive amounts of talent. Unfortunately, I think despite the good intentions of many teachers and schools out there, the school environment and the setup isn't necessarily conducive, you know, to meeting the needs of these children. And to be fair on, you know, many teachers and schools, it's something that they're not kind of trained to have to deal with. It's really hard, I think, to be able to meet the needs of, you know, the big classes that we have nowadays and all the variety in terms of the difficult, you know, strengths and difficulties that people kind of bring into the classroom. But certainly, being excluded from school, I think, is a massive issue. And to kind of add to that point a little bit more, the Prison Reform Trust came out with some statistics just back in December, quite recent, and they actually said that looking at the national prison population, 24% of people in prison were actually taken into care as a child, and an additional 42% of the prison population had actually experienced exclusion from education, which, compared to what you'd expect in the general population, is very high. So missing out on education is a big problem, and it creates barriers for later life then, which can feel insurmountable to some people.
Yeah, and I can ask you about sort of environment. You mentioned there the school environment, because people will think, well, maybe that child is, as a result of the environment and the you know, the background that they've got over a period of time, have developed into this sort of person who has this view on life, who has this particular issue because of the way that they've been brought up. But then, of course, then people come on board to try and help out, but it might well be, you know, a psychologist within a clinical environment. It might well be a teacher within a school environment, or it might be, you know, a foster home environment as well. How important is it about creating environments, sort of rewriting sort of the programming in the child's brain, which says, right, well, you believe this to be normal, but let's show a newer, safer normal, if you like.
The vast majority of the work I do in my day-to-day role is actually about working with the system around the child, i.e. with parents, carers, teachers, support workers, mentors, to actually help to co-create an ideal environment, a nurturing environment, so that children can fulfill their potential. Because absolutely, in terms of, you know, the stories that care experience people have shared with me, you know, Ian Dixon, who I referred to before, talked about how actually key relationships, it was the people that believed in him and supported him when he really needed it that he says actually saved his life, and that those relationships remain vital past the age of 18. So when I kind of think about environment, I do think about the built environment, you know, having a warm spaces, you know, cozy spaces, spaces where you're able to focus if it's at school, so on and so forth. But more importantly, I'm thinking about the relationships, because actually, for example, being a foster carer is a massive undertaking, and it's much harder than I think some people who enter this endeavour kind of realise in the first place, in that you need to be willing to move towards a young person's distress. And as human beings, it's hard to move towards pain, isn't it? Our inclination is to move away. So absolutely, those day-to-day interactions, the day-to-day relationships that looked after children are involved in part of, are absolutely fundamental. So it's important that we can accept what these young people bring, no matter how difficult it might be, that we can show some curiosity about where that has come from and what it is that they might need, and we can be playful in the way that we interact with them, and we have as much empathy as we possibly have in order to help them feel loved and cared for, and to be able to learn some of those really important skills around understanding feelings and being able to manage them better. It takes time, it's hard work, but it's not impossible with the right dedication and the right people.
And when you're doing that, when you're having those conversations, do you do it in a way which is, and now here's the bit where we're going to talk about your development and your mental health, or did you mention the word play there, you know, do you try and do it where you are trying to create an environment which allows professionals like yourself to do your work without actually letting the child know that they are under the scrutiny of, you know, a clinical psychologist?
Yeah. Absolutely, because looked after children, you know, they probably feel very scrutinised a lot of the time. Every aspect of their day-to-day life comes under a lot of scrutiny because they're under the care of the local authority. And actually, AC at the Care Kid, who I referred to earlier, is another one of the people that I correspond with on social media. He talked about the fact that he was having psychotherapy at one point at a young age for an hour a week, and he was like, I didn't even understand what it was about. I didn't even know that there was anything wrong with what had happened. So it's kind of too soon for him. So yeah, my focus absolutely is on making sure that looked after people, you know, have the best kind of people around them to look after them. So quite often, you know, it'll be in a space either at the home where the foster carers are, as an example, or perhaps in a meeting room near my office, to kind of talk about, you know, when you're with this young person, what comes up, you know, what do you find yourself, you know, kind of getting frustrated about? What's the lovely things about being with this young person? What do you get drawn into? Because we can get drawn into things. We can get kind of drawn into a bit of tit for tat with a young person and then wonder how on earth we got there. So it's about unpicking those interactions and trying to figure out what buttons that foster carer might have. What is it there'll be a button there that young person is just pressing, and the reason why they're pressing it is they're trying to get an attachment need met, i.e. they're trying to keep that carer close, they're trying to ensure that carer meets their needs, but in a way that feels safe for them. So sometimes it's not very sophisticated, sometimes it's clumsy, sometimes it can actually feel quite rejecting or hostile, but all they're trying to do is to kind of meet that need. So it's kind of helping foster carers be able to step back and have a think about what's happening when they're with the young person and come at things that way.
Yeah, I guess you don't want to go into one of these things as, hey then, kids, what's all this stuff that's happening on YouTube? You know, try and...
yeah.
Let's go and play COD on our Xboxes. Yeah, I guess you're on a bit of a tightrope walking there. But I guess this is the point here. So that, you know, kids are also kids, aren't they? And kids react to the world in a different way and see the world in a different way. But I guess that's why it's such a precious thing that we help these kids out. And if they've come from a difficult background, it's about putting them on that right path or showing them what that path can mean as well, so that they can still get to the point where they can enjoy life, do the things that kids want to do.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think this is another couple of issues that are worth mentioning while I kind of, you know, have a listening ear, as it were, which is that actually in foster care, what can happen is that children go from placement to placement. People go into foster care with good intentions of offering good care, but the challenges are such that sometimes people do find themselves not being able to continue with offering a home to a young person. But for that young person, that means going, you know, from pillar to post. So AC or At The Care Kid was talking about how, you know, he was quite boisterous and unruly and cheeky as a child. He was desperate for love and attention. He just wanted to make people laugh. But it came through as naughty behaviour, which people just didn't seem to understand and sometimes didn't seem to want to understand. Some foster placements, of course, the families have difficulties of their own. And you know, that means that things can, you know, fall apart that way. But you can end up moving from town to town, to school, and actually never feel like you have a home of your own. That's how he kind of put it. And if people can take a little bit of time to think about what that might be like, and I think it has to be a conscious thing doing that, because we kind of take the things that we have for granted sometimes. That's massive. And that's what occurred to me when I first worked in children's homes. I would imagine the children I work with sometimes sitting on the bed at night and actually feeling like they were completely on their own in the world. And I think if we can, it's a painful place to take ourselves to, but if we can tolerate it, we might be able to have a sense of what it's like to be a looked after child sometimes.
We talk many times on this programme, Sarah, about what you can do with children up to a certain point before their issues, beyond that point, fall into later life, become issues as an adult, right, and sometimes can then reflect on the issues that they've faced as well. In terms of the, I don't know if you'll have a cut-off point, because I doubt you'd say, right, that's it, child, you've had your time, you need to move on now. What do you see in terms of that, in terms of trying to, you know, put a block on the road, find a treatment scheme for a child or get them on a certain pathway, which means that you think, right, I know that when they get to adulthood, they're not going to fall into some of the pitfalls, they're not going to start maybe showing some of the signs of things that they experienced growing up.
Yeah. I mean, in an ideal world, I think a lot of people would buy into the idea of early intervention as far as possible. And more broadly speaking, as services, the issue for experiences of care experienced people they're not just about the incidents that happened before they went into care. They're about lots of things. I mentioned domestic violence earlier, you know, substance misuse, all sorts out there, you know, even issues around kind of postnatal health. All these things can kind of impact on what happens to a child and their trajectory. So early intervention, support in services that can actually help parents in the early stages of becoming a family, you know, might be able to do some of that preventative work. Certainly, you know, I think it's important to remain hopeful, and I would always do my best to work with the people around a child as far as possible, particularly if the young person doesn't feel like they want to sit down with somebody and think about things, because they might not, like you said earlier, they just kind of want to get on with their lives. And I think the reality is that some people find that later on in life, in adulthood, that's the time at which, you know, they feel like they can reflect. They might feel like they then have people in their lives who are there for them and care about them no matter what. Not everybody does, but some do. And it's those things that can make a difference. So it is impossible to kind of put a time frame on it. But certainly I think the adults around children, you know, will always need to connect with the idea that they need to do as much as they can to offer the experiences to a child they've missed out on.
Sarah Wolfe is with us. She's a clinical psychologist. She trained and was based here in Liverpool, now works up in Lancashire, sharing her story on Mental Health Monday. Sarah, in terms of, can I ask you this? This sounds awful. The sort of things that you hear, can that have an impact on you? I was talking to my wife about this because she works in a primary school, and we were talking about, you know, some of the issues that, you know, young people might face. And I thought, well, if you're sitting in a psychologist, you know, chair and you're hearing these things, is there a danger that sometimes you hear things which you maybe take away with you, which you know, will haunt your own thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, certainly, you know, I've heard some stories that I will never forget, both for positive reasons, hopeful reasons, but also, you know, because they are horrific stories. I like to think that if a young person has to be able to sit with that as their reality, then I can as well. But certainly, you know, in my profession, I think one of the things that is a privilege in my profession is that I meet with somebody on a weekly basis to kind of talk through the families and the children that I'm working with. And that involves exploring, you know, where things might have, you know, been particularly tricky to kind of sit with, whereas I have to say other colleagues don't necessarily have access to that kind of support. So for example, I think one of the issues in places like residential care is actually you have some great residential support workers with good intentions, but they don't necessarily have the kind of support, you know, that clinical psychologists enjoy in terms of a space to be able to explore the impact of some of these things.
Yeah.
And certainly self-care is, you know, a responsibility of every kind of caring professional, you know. And it's important to be able to connect with those feelings, because without them, you're never really going to appreciate somebody's position. And no matter how hard it is to hear some stories, they need to be heard. And the voices of care experienced people need to be out there, you know, much more than they are at the moment. And that's not without, you know, the efforts of care experienced people themselves. It's about people like me kind of helping to get the word out that there are some stories to be told, as difficult as they are to hear.
Yeah, and in terms of training for that one there, I know that, you know, foster families do some absolutely wonderful work, but in terms of that,
yeah,
that training, the preparation that they have there, is that where it needs to be at the moment, or does there need to be more support within the system so that those people have specific training for maybe children who've got specific issues?
Yeah, absolutely. Because, you know, as a foster carer, you never really know how it's going to go for a child on placement in your home until they arrive and you're dealing with it day to day. Every child is different. So certainly, I think the availability and the timeliness of support for foster carers is absolutely crucial. I'm always cautioning foster carers against the idea that, you know, don't ring me last minute. When you see some issues, when you feel yourself starting to get frustrated and disconnecting from that young person, call me then. Don't call me a few weeks later when things have got, you know, really, really difficult. People are sometimes hesitant to ask for help. You know, it's difficult. And I think, you know, in these kind of caring professions, people don't necessarily get, the broader support and encouragement that they kind of deserve. So it's easy to feel like you're not doing good enough, when actually it's just that you need to have the chance to try something different, but you need to know what to try. So that's why, you know, it's helpful to get the involvement of others.
No, absolutely. Sarah, just before we let you go, one last thing from me. Is there anything that you're seeing at the moment from a, you know, a trends point of view? And I know you take a look at, you know, all kinds of things like socioeconomic, you know, context of young people and things like that. Is there one particular trend which causes you particular concern that maybe isn't getting a spotlight shone on it in the way that maybe you feel that it should have? Maybe something which keeps coming up where you're thinking, there's a link here that I'm seeing, and I'm seeing maybe a gap in knowledge maybe, or a gap in training that might be there for people in the future?
I think in terms of my work with kind of foster carers and other people in the system around the child, but particularly foster carers, I think there's something about our hopes and expectations when we put ourselves or try to get into those kind of roles. And like I say, I think most people that wish to become foster carers have good intentions of opening up their home. And that's 24/7, that's not 9-to-5, you know, that's massive. But naturally humans will daydream about the things to come, the things they look forward to. And I think sometimes we can have a bit of an idealized image that if we can just provide a nice home and some routine and a bit of discipline, that any child who comes through the door will be absolutely fine. And actually, you know, a child could be removed within the first few weeks of life, but difficulties can still emerge behaviorally, emotionally later on. So sometimes the daydreams, the hopes, the wishes, the expectations, we can want to desperately hold on to that, but that can sometimes mean that we're not willing to open ourselves up to what actually arrives. So it would be nice to think that people could have more opportunity to just explore some of that, really.
Sarah, thank you for your time today. Thanks for joining us on Mental Health Monday. Really fascinating insight. If people want to find out more about the work that you do, you're on social media. Can I give out your Twitter handle?
Of course you can. Absolutely.
If you'd have gone, no, I would have been fine as well. It's at Sarah with an H, S-A-R-A-H, Wolf with an E on the end, and then Psych, P-S-Y-C-H. That's at Sarah Wolf Psych. And we'll get a link on our social media as well, Sarah, so that people can follow you through that one on at Radio City Talk. Thank you for joining us on the programme today. Really appreciate you speaking to us.
Thanks very much. And if I could just give a shout out to Ian Dixon, Gavin Sinclair, and of course AC at the Care Kids for their help.
Brilliant. Yeah, it sounds like you really got a good community going on social media. Absolutely. I'll make sure I join it. Absolutely. Sarah Wolf, thank you for your time. Really appreciate you joining us on the programme. That's Sarah Wolf, who is a clinical psychologist, joining us on Mental Health Monday, the first one of 2018.
Radio City Talk. Tackling the stigma.
So it is the 8th of January 2018. In 1 week's time, the 15th of January, we are about to embark on the Mental Health Monday marathon. So from 9 o'clock in the morning on the 15th, we are going to be starting to talk about mental health. And we're going to do that, and we're going to carry on doing it until 9 a.m. on Tuesday, the 16th of January 2018. I've got my years right, Producer Lizzie, right? Yeah, we're not doing it for more than a year.
I'd hope not.
It seemed like a good idea when we first came up with it, and then the realities are starting to dawn on us about the logistics around it. So you're working... Oh, no, you're not working over the top. You're doing all the work that needs to be done to make this work. But we are lining up essentially a full day's worth of scheduled radio programming based around mental health.
Yes, it's taking a lot of time, a lot of effort, but it will be worth it. I'm interested to see how we're going to get on really early in the morning. But, you know, there's some big names, some, you know, a lot of people who you'll recognise from the Mental Health Monday podcast as well. Being inundated, to be honest, with requests. And I thought when we first come up with the idea of a 24-hour show, I was thinking, how on earth am I going to fill 24 hours? Now I'm trying to cram everyone in because so many people have got in touch, and obviously I want to make sure that everyone who's got in touch gets to have their say one way or another. Basically.
So over the course of the 24 hours, what we're doing, rather than just go, right, let's talk about mental health, we're actually having a period where we can sit down and talk with local organisations, find about the work that they do. We'll have a section on children and mental health as well. Postnatal depression we'll be doing mental health within the workplace. We'll be doing a phone-in as well.
And we're Pete Price
is coming back to do his phone-in for us on that one as well. We've also got a section on post-traumatic stress disorder, some of the issues that are being faced by people as they are either in or leaving the armed forces as well. And we're also going to have a heavy sport contingent as well. Now, we're doing the show on the 15th of January, officially the most depressing day of the year, Blue Monday. Dave Downey is a blue. He's an Everton fan.
Every Monday's a Blue Monday.
But Dave, we're speaking to sports stars who are going to share their story. So it's going to be a sports show as such. We're going to be doing between 7:30 and 10, which is going to be shining a light on, you know, how sports stars feel outside of whether or not they're winning or losing in whichever sport they're taking place in.
Yeah, that's right. And I think it's a completely different dynamic. I mean, each of us that have suffered with mental health issues, your problems are personal to you. But I think in the sporting sort of spectrum, it's completely different because you've got the pressures of being in the public eye. And I think that's what we really want to get across on the day, is how they deal with it. Because I'm not saying it's any worse than anybody else's, but to have it under such public scrutiny is, I would think, a lot more challenging than having to cope with it internally and personally yourself. So the sort of individuals we're hoping to get lined up are going to be able to give us a view of what their personal issues have been and how they've gone about tackling it and how they've gone about maybe giving something back as well. Because I think that is what slips under the radar. I think when we read about people in the public eye who've had issues with mental health, it's what they go on to do afterwards, and often many of them do give something back. They get involved in charities, even by a lot of them bring out books and their own published works and things like that. So it's hopefully going to be some inspirational stuff as well, things that maybe will help people who are listening to it with issues themselves, obviously, that are not in the public eye and don't have the help readily available that these people do.
I think as well, that's the other thing, because people always presume that because you're a sports star, you got loads of money, and therefore what problems are you really going to have? But I guess the other thing is, if you're dealing with your own mental health problems, that there's no escape, is there, for us? But you can't just think, well, I'll just go and do the shopping, try and take my mind off it. You know, you get recognised everywhere, and people go, oh, yeah, I saw such and such a body who plays football for, oh, he was, you know, oh, he didn't even want to post for a photo. You don't have a clue, do you?
No.
You know, what's going on in people's heads?
That's exactly right. And you're in sort of a, not a protective bubble, but one that's, I can imagine, is quite volatile, really, one that you can't escape from. And I think that's why we're seeing it as more of a prominent issue in sport now, that people are coming forward and seeing that it's good to speak out. And obviously we hope our show sort of propels that a little bit more and makes people realise that it's fine to talk about it. And the ones that have come forward so far, I'm sure that's just the tip of the iceberg, really. And there's so many others who probably maybe don't feel as brave, maybe don't even want to. But I think that's what you really want to try and hit with a show like ours, is cover as many bases as you can. Because each case of it, I've always found the people I've spoken to is unique from another. So we need to get as many people's voices out as we possibly can so they can talk about it and maybe others can relate to it.
And what we'll do with it, as much as the 24 hours as we can, we'll be sort of dividing it up, putting it on our social media, be able to watch the whole thing through Facebook Live. Does that not cut off after, like, I don't know. Well, you'll be able to watch videos of it as well. And I guess people might find, Lizzie, a 15-minute chunk in the 24 hours, which is relevant to them or somebody within their family. And actually, for them hearing that at that time, that might be the requirement, or that might be the moment that they think, right, actually, I might need to speak out about that, or I might need to, you know, point someone in the direction of that so that they can get the help.
Well, I'd certainly hope so. We've got some great people lined up so far, and like I say, still a lot of people, you know, due to confirm. But there's such a range of issues and topics that we're going to be covering. I mean, there's a full hour where the Samaritans are going to be in from 4 till 5 in the morning. And I know that sounds like an extremely late time to be listening, but there will be people out there who, you know, might be suffering and might think, you know what, I'd like to tune into that hour and let's see what I can do about my mental health. And hopefully there's something, someone that you hear that will encourage you to speak out, whether it be a phone call to the Samaritans, whether it be speaking to your family, speaking to your friends, or your GP. Hopefully there's something there to inspire people to speak out.
That's the task we've got, though, Lizzie, isn't it, is that we've got to try and make this as accessible as possible. So if you're not up at 4 in the morning, you do particularly pay interest to that part of the show, we're going to have it on demand as quickly as possible and make it as accessible, and probably have a catalogue or something like that that we're going to put out.
Absolutely. So we will do our best to make sure everything just works straightforwardly as possible, makes it as easy as possible to get hold of. So, for instance, it will be on Facebook Live through our Radio City Talk Facebook page, just like that now, and then you'll be into the feed on that one. We'll also be doing live updates on at Radio City Talk, and of course the whole day is live across Radio City Talk. That's 1548 medium wave across Merseyside. We're on DAB Digital Radio. You can listen live, radiocitytalk.co.uk, or check out the Radio City app and you can get updates there. We've got loads of great guests lined up as well. We're just waiting for a confirmation of a couple more who we're hoping to box off in the next, 24 to 48 hours. And then it's about staying up for 24 hours. We'll come on to how we're going to do that as well. We're going to have guests on throughout the entire course of the day, and hopefully some really interesting guests, including podcast listeners. You're about to hear Jake Mills, who's going to join me for the entire 24 hours as well, from the Chasing the Stigma charity. So you'll hear all that. Regular listeners to Mental Health Monday will know it will return in its regular form in 2 weeks' time, but next week is the Mental Health Monday Marathon.
Mental Health Monday with Mick Coyle. This is Radio City Talk.
Okay, so here's a little bit extra for the Mental Health Monday podcast, first one of 2018, and as promised, Jake Mills from Chasing the Stigma. Jake, thanks for your time.
Thank you for having me.
Me and you are going to get to know each other quite a lot, I think, in the next week or so.
Yeah, it seemed like a good idea at first, didn't it?
It really did. And I think it's starting to dawn on me as well that, you know, 24 hours is a long time to talk. But I guess, you know, when you and I first had the conversation, the whole point was, well, if we can do it for 24 hours, that might inspire one person to talk about their own mental health for 2 minutes, 5 minutes, 10 minutes, share their own story with their friends, their group, whoever it is they knock around with, a colleague at work, whoever it might be.
Yeah, and you know, as you kind of have already discussed, but the fact that to come up with the idea 24 hours, it is a long time. It's a really long time. It seems like an even longer time now than when we came up with the idea. But we knew that we would be able to fill that time with people who were willing to talk about it, people who were doing amazing things. And I mean, yeah, like, people just haven't stopped coming forward to say we want to be involved. And it just shows how eager and how willing people are to have that conversation and to fill the, you know, for me, the important thing is that we're filling that time with really good, real stories and advice and help and about services that exist. And it's just, this can be such a positive thing for so many people.
And I think as well, you know, this is about, you know, your charity's Chasing the Stigma, and the whole point of what you're doing is about tackling the stigma around mental health. And I guess the fact that you've said there, you know, the number of people who are coming forward who want to talk on the Mental Health Monday Marathon, or have talked to us and spoken in other, you know, media formats in the last 12 months or so, just goes to show that stigma, it is being chipped away at, isn't it?
It is. And what you're doing and what we're doing with this is you providing that platform for people to talk about it, because I think there's a big myth that people don't want to talk about it, just don't know how to talk about it. And I think by having one conversation, then you create about another 10, 11, 12 conversations just from that one. And I think people, what it does is it fills people with confidence that you can talk about it, and ideas and ways of talking about it in a nice, safe, comfortable environment, which is what you've created and what we're going to help create on for 24 hours.
And I guess when you and I sit down at 9 o'clock, we'll have our own conversation about your own story and the own work that you do through Chasing the Stigma, but also through the Hub of Hope as well. And then we'll have that conversation with all those individuals and their own experiences of mental health. And I think that's going to be one of the interesting things for me, how those stories are similar, but also how very different those stories are. This idea that mental health is one thing, but if it's got parity esteem with physical health, then you can either have a broken arm, or you can have a broken leg, or you can have a migraine. There's 1,001 different issues that we could be talking about.
Exactly, and that's the thing really, is that no matter what you feel, no matter what you think, somebody somewhere has felt that and thought it as well. But there are so many different ways, different kind of, everyone's different, everyone feels differently about different things. Even if it's exactly the same experience, you can feel and think differently about it. But I think kind of I've been talking quite openly about my kind of depression and suicide attempt for 4 years ago. And even all the interviews that I do, or all the discussions I have, I love when you hear about other people's experience and being able to associate that to yourself. And it's even things that maybe I have not even picked up on in all that time kind of talking about it, but hearing somebody else describe their kind of feelings or their experience, you think, actually, do you know what? I did feel that, and I didn't even realise that was part of it. And that's the power of talking, that's the power of sharing your experience, your stories, because it can help people without you even realising.
Now, that's really interesting, actually, Jake, because, you know, you and I have spoken about mental health, your own mental health, your own story for many, many years. And actually, you being here for the 24 hours, you obviously have an insight maybe into this that other people, including myself, wouldn't actually have. But actually, I was going to say to you then, do you think you're going to learn anything? Is this going to be beneficial to you and your own journey, do you think?
I'd like to think so. Although I know, I mean, you pick up different things and different triggers and different kind of things that will help or not help your own mental health. And one of my things where I know that my mental health can suffer or can strain a little bit is lack of sleep. So in a way, I'm going to feel worse for it. But I would like to think that I'll be able to pick up a lot of experience, a lot of ideas. And I'm really, really looking forward to it, because I think it can help so many people, and I think it can be a massive insight that nobody else is doing anywhere else. And what we're going to be able to pull together really can help people, and I honestly believe that.
You know, it's funny, actually, you talk about lack of sleep and that some of the issues around it. When I became a parent for the first time, I kind of thought, well, you know what? It just turns out you can cope with most things as a parent as long as you've had a good night's sleep. So like the last 3 years, I've absolutely placed having a good night's sleep as my number one priority in life. And there's going to come a moment, maybe around, you know, 9:30, 10 o'clock, when Pete Price comes on and joins us, actually, that secretly I'm going to be thinking, now's be the point where I'd be thinking, get ready for bed now, jump in bed, get a good night's sleep, and everything will be fine with the world. Knowing deep down as well that we've still got another 11 and a half hours, however many hours left to go. I think that's going to be one of the real challenges for me personally.
Yeah, exactly the same. Exactly the same. Yeah, but, you know, and, you know, we both have young children as well. So it's not just the 24 hours that we're awake, it's the night before. And the night after, I know my son Teddy, he has a weird way of knowing exactly when I've got a busy day ahead of me, and that's when he's awake in the night. So, yeah, it's the night before, it's all that. So it's going to be a challenge. But you know what? We're doing it for all the right reasons, and I'm really excited about it.
Yeah. In a perfect world, Jake, I'd have booked a hotel room right next to the studios. I'd have rolled out of bed at 8:35. I'd have had a cup of coffee, and I'd have been rolled in at 8:55 and rock and roll, tried to be as efficient as possible. As a parent, it's just not possible at all.
No, I mean, we've missed the trick, really, because we could have done it as a John and Yoko in bed 24-hour mental health podcast, but yeah, it's too late now, unfortunately.
Chasing the Stigma and the Hub of Hope, thehubofhope.co.uk, where you can find out more information about the services which are available near you when it comes to mental health. And Jake Mills joining us on the programme today. He is going to be with me for the full 24 hours. I'm hoping by the time Pete Price comes on, Jake, that might be time to go and get some tea or at least eat. Right, 10 o'clock at night, that should be enough time to go and get something to eat, right?
Yeah, you'd think so. I mean, I'm planning on helping the time pass by eating constantly, really, but you know, we'll have to just work it out.
We'll go for that. I will absolutely go for that. Jake, thank you for your time. We'll see you next week. People can listen to Jake as part of the Mental Health Monday marathon alongside myself at a full 24 hours starting, that is at 9 a.m. on Monday, the 15th of January, 2018. I'm trying to convince myself that it's absolutely happening while I'm saying that. And Jake, thank you for your time today.
Thank you very much.
Okay, so Mental Health Monday as a podcast returns in 2 weeks' time, but don't forget you can get the full Mental Health Monday marathon via our Facebook page. That will be a Facebook Live video. You'll be able to watch that. And also you can check out previous editions of Mental Health Monday. Just type in Mental Health Monday podcast into any search provider and you'll get a list of all the previous editions. You're with Radio City Talk. This is Mental Health Monday. I've been Mick Coyle. We'll see you for the Mental Health Monday marathon.
Radio City Talks Mental Health Monday with Mick Coyle.